agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
Mike, I can honestly say I'm feeling better today than at any time since the U.S. Civil War. That's not hyperbole.
All right. Well, that's good. Have you in fine fettle? I'll have to gird my loins? What do you do with your loins? I don't know.
I think that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, gird. I will gird them up anyway. So, you know, there was one story I thought we could start with before we get started with our story. We want to thank our newest supporter on Patreon, Daniel. So thank you, Daniel, very much for supporting the show. And of course, as most of you know, when you're a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length episode every week. You get ad-free versions of all our shows, other things at different levels of support. And if you want to become a supporter, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you would like to get that bonus show, but you're not in a position where you can financially support the podcast right now, totally not a problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up. And also, we have, as I mentioned for a while now, joined the 21st century, and you can now support us through Venmo. We're at Politics Guys. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about DACA being ruled illegal and the ramifications of that, the Senate Democrats' $3.5 trillion budget agreement, inflation concerns, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's bill to decriminalize marijuana, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's proposal to change how the military prosecutes serious crimes, vaccine hostility on the right, and Justice Breyer's not quite yet retirement. That's an awful lot. And so whatever we don't get to on this show, we will move over into our midweek supporters bonus show. But before we get started, we'll just take a quick break and be right back. Okay, Jay. So I thought we could lead off this morning with a story that actually broke pretty late on Friday. And I know I haven't had a chance to really dig into it, but I thought we should probably talk at least a little bit about it since it's been a recurring story since really the beginning of the podcast. And that's the DACA. On Friday, U.S. District Judge Andrew Hannon, a George W. Bush appointee, declared DACA illegal. He barred the government from approving any new applications for the program, but left it intact for existing recipients. And there are around 650,000 or so of those. And as listeners will, I'm sure, recall, former President Barack Obama started DACA back in 2012. The Trump administration then announced it was ending the program in 2017. But it didn't do it in the right way, according to the Supreme Court, and they ruled in 2020 that they hadn't ended it properly, and so it kept it alive. But as Jay, I know neither of us has had a chance to read the actual opinion, but for years now,
I just didn't.
Other things going. There you go. Well, but I know that you and I have been kind of one mind, at least on the legality of DACA. And from the beginning, I've said that, hey, I think this is a great program if it were passed by Congress. But it seems to me pretty clear that it's outside the president's legitimate powers to do that sort of thing.
And you'd be exactly right. And so is Judge Hannon, who is apparently has been listening to the show for years.
You know,
I think he gets it right. It's interesting also, again, sort of put in a grandfather clause, so to speak, for folks who have been here, and there's no retroactive effect. He didn't grant the injunction,
right.
But clearly said that this is unconstitutional. And that's in line with the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals some years ago had indicated the same thing. And then Trump put in his order to repeal it. And again, I mean, this is all sort of water under the bridge at this point. But, the idea that something being unconstitutional isn't a good enough reason to repeal it, sort of still strikes me as odd. But I think this is, you're exactly right. And the judge is exactly right on this.
And do you think that this is going to make it easier to pass some sort of legislation like the Dream Act or something, you know, something like that. I mean, President Biden has said that he wants a path to citizenship for, you know, 11 million plus people in this country illegally. I don't see anything that big happening, but there has been some talk, for instance, about immigration being part of the budget reconciliation bill, which we'll talk about later. I'm skeptical as to whether that actually meets the Byrd rule requirement. Requirements to be part of that, but that aside, do you think that this makes some sort of immigration reform more likely than it was, say, before Friday?
Not in the least. no, long term, yeah, maybe. But consider this is a district court. The government's going to appeal it, obviously. So then you're going to go to a Circuit Court of Appeals, and that process is going to take probably about a year or so. And then whoever loses that will seek cert from the U.S. Supreme Court, who may or may not pick it up. And in the meantime, there may be other district courts that rule on this. So I think I think if you're talking about eventually, does this force the issue? Maybe, but is it going to affect any immediate changes? No.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty solid analysis of it, certainly. So we certainly will be coming back to this as it moves its way through the court system. But for now, I thought we could maybe move on to what we thought would be our original top story, and that is the big budget announcement. Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee agreed this week on a $3.5 trillion budget framework, which is considerably less than some progressives were hoping for. But it looks right now like the Senate's sort of left flank is on board with the plan. I mean, Senator Bernie Sanders, who's the chair of the Budget Committee, called it a pivotal moment in American history. Though that said, it's still, I think, unclear to me, at least, whether...
That's not hyperbole.
You know, well, I mean, still, I actually agree with Bernie on that, but it's pretty, I think it's unclear as to whether all 50 Senate Democrats are going to support that. You know, a lot of the focus is on, of course, the two moderates we talk about all the time, Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, you know, because in response to this announcement, Manchin was pretty noncommittal, I think. He said, we need to pay for it. I don't think we need more debt. So it wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement. And right now, we're just at that framework stage. But what we do know is about some of the broader policy goals. For instance, it's supposed to include funding for President Biden's plan for 2 years of free community college, expanding Medicare to include vision, dental, and hearing coverage, expanding Medicaid, paid family medical leave, lowering prescription drug costs, investing in programs to combat climate change, expanding support for families with children. And there's even talk, as I mentioned, for changes in the immigration process, though, again, I think that might run afoul of the Byrd rule, which says that that non-budgetary provisions can't be considered under reconciliation rules. And that seems to me to maybe fall within that. But
And again, for folks who haven't fallen along, this is something that the Senate would have to do by reconciliation because they would not have the votes to do it by a simple majority otherwise.
Yeah. So no question this will be done through reconciliation. And the other part I should mention is paying for it all. Again, this is pretty vague at this point, but the plan right now, it seems to be that Democrats want to kind of unwind some of the Republican tax cuts that were passed in 2017, raise taxes on overseas profits of U.S. corporations, revise a whole bunch of tax credits given to largely fossil fuel energy companies, raise taxes on inheritances and capital gains, and increasing funding to the IRS for more enforcement. And this, you know, this $3.5 trillion, this comes in addition, of course, to the infrastructure bill, which is expected to total somewhere around $1.2 trillion. And there's still some hope, I guess, among some folks that that infrastructure bill will win the votes of at least 10 Senate Republicans. But here, as you and I, you know, you just mentioned, there's no real expectation this is going to get any Republican support. So it's going to need all 50 Democrats to sign on, then the vice president's tiebreaker to pass. So what do you think about this budget proposal, at least, you know, kind of what we know about it at this point, Jay?
Well, to me, it looks like it's, you know, again, Sanders says, sort of pivotal moment in American history. It's really sort of the same. It's kind of what you'd expect, and then sort of the same thing that the Democrats have been proposing perennially, right? To me, it's sort of nothing. There's nothing new. It's just sort of spend a lot more money on stuff that we already spend a lot of money on. And you know, that's sort of the playbook, and I get it. Is it 3.5 trillion is a huge number. I think there are issues about how you pay for it. You know, Mike, in the past, I always sort of branded myself as a fiscal hawk. And I may be sort of one of the last one of those. I mean, it's just sort of gone by the wayside, particularly after the pandemic. And there reaches this sort of weird, you know, you see this in people or companies that are approaching bankruptcy, right? That, well, look, we're already broke. What's an extra $3 trillion? Might as well go out with a bang. So there's some sort of thought, I think, there. My sense is it gets pared down eventually, as these things do. But it's still going to be a huge amount. And I think that the other piece of this is when we start talking about how you actually fund it, it's the spending is always easier to propose than the paying for it is. And when you're talking about things like corporate taxes on over companies overseas and so forth, you start getting into these areas where you may have one, diminishing returns, and second, you may have unintended consequences. Yeah. I mean, one of the big things that you and I agreed on the tax cuts, Trump tax cuts, was that it provided an incentive or a disincentive for companies to move overseas to avoid taxes.
Right.
And this might seem to go against that and restart that that exodus. The parallel, you know, piece that they sort of is the backstop on this, of course, is the Treasury's push to get a global, you know, sort of agreement on taxation, which you know, other people would call a cartel, but
yeah,
you know, and that would sort of hedge our bets, right? I mean, then you would say, well, look, Ireland can't go below this, but still, even with what Yellen has proposed and what seems to be the likely drift of that, and assuming everybody abides by it, there would still be a significant difference between U.S. corporate taxes and overseas. So I think it's not unreasonable that if, you know, they make the big push for corporate taxes, you see some corporations say, okay, well, we'll go to wherever.
You're right. I think, and you have to kind of weigh the possibility of that against the revenue you generate from that, from the companies that don't do that. Because in many instances, obviously, it's, you know, if you're just making widgets, well, you can do that pretty much anywhere. But there's something to be said for being in certain areas with a core of talent and people around you. And that's still not something we can really replicate with Zoom or technology at this point. So it can be, you know, difficult to just move, basically.
But you can still move your corporate offices to Dublin.
Sure, I see what you're saying. Right.
Right. I mean, the inversion sort of stuff. So yeah. So yeah, your company is still being to some extent taxed on what it does in the country, but it's corporate profits. If they're realized in another country, those profits don't get taxed unless and until they're brought back into the US.
Yeah. Though I think, so, you know, I got to say that even some pretty centrist economists and even some right leaning economists like Douglas Holtz Eakin, they calculate that Biden's that all these proposed tax hikes will shave off maybe around 0.2% of GDP over time. And the AEI, American Enterprise Institute, which are no, you know, socialist crazy group, right?
Right.
They say it's going to be probably even less than that. And so, you know, I think you need to take a look, obviously, at the long-term effects on economic growth, but weigh that against things like, actually, I mean, you mentioned that there's not a whole lot new. I would say, well, a lot of it's expanding, but something like including dental and vision and hearing care in Medicaid, which is crazy to me that it's not part of that in the first place, that is something I think that's pretty different, at least in the U.S. context, certainly not internationally, where, you know, as listeners, I'm sure know, the U.S. is the only rich country to not offer some form of universal health care. But this is at least a step in that direction.
Yeah, but to me, I think the price tag on that is that's not where your $3.5 trillion's coming in. Right. And I mean, as much as I'm not crazy about expanding welfare state entitlements and so forth, adding dental and vision and stuff to Medicare, I mean, it's increased government spending, but it's not of the magnitude that changes things. And I get you're saying, well, it's coverage of a different kind that hasn't been offered before. I look at it as just, well, we're adding a couple more benefits to what you already had. And that's probably not where the big piece comes.
It's definitely big. And it's interesting to me, I'm sure to you too, how comfortable we've gotten talking about trillions of dollars since the pandemic, which is definitely a change. There was a story about a President Obama back in, sometime during his presidency, asking some advisors what he should propose for an infrastructure bill, and saying something like, and don't tell me to spend $1 trillion because that's not possible. Well, all of a sudden, we're in a new reality here. But, you know, I want to say that while I think that in the end, this is to get like Manchin and maybe Sinema on board, it's going to have to be mostly paid for. That deficit spending can't be a big part of it. I think it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, this is the time to do deficit spending. When you take a look at interest rates, you know, below 2%, Biden budget proposals actually argue that net interest payments over time may actually end up being negative after you factor in inflation. And so, you know, if you're going to borrow,
we're losing money if we don't do it,
you know, practically so. So this is a good time. When you look at historical charts about interest rates and inflation, this sure does seem to be a good time to do that. And of course, it's not like we're throwing money down a hole. Now, you might differ from me in some of these programs, but a lot of these things actually are things that could help to certainly increase security and economic growth and do some pretty good things.
That's kind of like the argument I make to my wife when I want to buy, like, you know, new like boating equipment or something. You know, come on, you know, we're losing money if we don't jump at this deal now. I think you're right on all those things. I'm disappointed in myself that I can't muster, at least not on a rainy Saturday morning, a more emphatic cry against this kind of government spending, because that used to be my thing. But I think there is just sort of on the right, sort of an exception or acceptance or exhaustion, on the spending front, and realizing, look, this we're not gonna win this battle this time, right? I think it's going to be a big number. You can trim it down some, and I think that's what will happen. But it's, you know, you're not going to get a skinny government budget from this administration and a 50-50 Senate.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So it's going to be a big package, but I also agree with you that it's not going to end up being $3.5 trillion, but certainly bigger than anyone on the conservative side in the Senate would be comfortable with. But you know, I think it's important to try to put this into some larger context. And oftentimes when I think about government spending, I try to think not just in terms of what we in the United States have done in the past, but I like to look at kind of overall trends for the rich countries in the world. And I tend to look at that. I'm kind of a data nerd, the OECD database, because that's pretty much the 38 richest countries in the world. And when you look at compare U.S. spending, you know, in the context of OECD, where we rank 31st out of 38 in terms of spending as a percentage of GDP. So it's not like we're, you know, crazed throwing around money. Now, this is going to move us up maybe a little bit, but you know, based on these kind of international standards with sort of comparable countries, we still spend an awful lot less and do an awful lot less for our people than, say, the European model. And you would say that's a good thing, certainly.
Yeah.
And I would say that's
which is why I think so many, you know, European countries have had big unemployment issues and economic stagnation and so forth, you know, over the past decade or so. But that's sort of another story. But
And, you know, from the moving to the kind of politics side of things, it seems to me that this is a time to act because Democrats really have a pretty narrow window. I mean, I would say there's a pretty good chance that Republicans are going to win one or both chambers in 2022, at which point that, you know, this goes out the window, basically. And not only that, but I think what a lot of folks don't recognize is with that 50-50 split, right now, for instance, there are six Democratic senators over the age of 70 who represent states where there's a Republican governor who would appoint their replacement if they die in office. And, you know, that happened, certainly, right? And there's only one.
That's why let's fund those Medicare benefits, man.
But you know, on the Republican side, that's only the case for one senator, and that's Mitch McConnell, who is through some bizarre quirk of fate, actually just having a really unpopular Republican incumbent running for re-election in Kentucky. Now there's a Democrat in as governor of Kentucky, at least for a short period of time. But, you know, also, I guess, I think this will happen, and I think you think this will happen. What about the sort of accompanying infrastructure bill? Do you still think that there's a possibility of this, of that actually being bipartisan, of that actually not of getting enough Republican votes to avoid a filibuster? Because McConnell has not been as anti-infrastructure bill, at least, than maybe he has been for some other things. And I wanted to get your take on that.
So I think one, Biden completely blew it on the infrastructure bill. And for a couple of different ways. I mean, one, that so much of it is not really infrastructure in the traditional or actual understanding of what that word means, meaning roads, bridges, you know, electric grids, that kind of thing, and more this human infrastructure, which is stuff that would be more properly put into the budget bill that we just talked about. And Republicans are typically more apt to support infrastructure because the idea is you are investing in something solid, something worthwhile. It is an investment in your future. You're building the road.
And, as opposed to people. Don't invest in them.
Well, no. It's a matter of capital expenses versus operating expenses. Right. And on the one hand, it often makes sense to spend more on some capital expenses than it does to have continually high and accelerating and increasing operating expenses. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, does that...
Yeah, I mean, I think the way most people on the left...
I hope our listeners get that, right? I mean, if it's a matter of, look, if I build a bridge, that bridge will be there in 30 years or so and will continue to serve people for all that time. If I just increase the layout of how much government's paying and the earned income tax credit, for example, what am I getting for that? Well, you want to say, okay, I'm getting some sort of stimulus value. I'm helping some people in the short term, but long term, I'm just building in an entitlement that I'll keep having to pay for.
Yeah. See, and on the left, we tend to view this as actually investing in human capital, and these are important ongoing investments, just like regular bridge maintenance is important. And so it's the old
teach a man to fish kind of thing, right? Infrastructure is more the we're providing fishing poles as opposed to operating expenses is more just we just keep handing out fish.
Yeah, and I'm saying on the left, well, we wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, but we would actually argue that doing things like making sure that people's insurance isn't tied to their health insurance isn't tied to their job and that they have some sort of a safety net beneath them and have educational opportunities and childcare and so forth actually is giving them the opportunity to go out into the workforce and to take risks and be entrepreneurs and do that sort of stuff that grows the economy. So we don't see that as handouts. We see that as just some sort of a basic support structure that allows people to do the sort of things that we would hope that I think most Americans would do in the workforce.
Oh, okay. Well,
all right. okay. Before we move on and talk about actually
there was something else I was going to say.
Oh, yeah, please do.
And that is, look, the other piece of this is, and I, so often I think people just don't understand the Republican mentality. And I think this is important for a story we'll probably talk about later. And I've often said there's often the lament of, can no one here play this game? And that was sort of the feeling everyone got when, okay, we negotiated an infrastructure deal with the president. And then immediately thereafter, he says, yep, this is a great bill and I'll sign this if you also agree to all these other things. And look, Republicans got hosed on that and they know it. And the Republican voters get particularly frustrated when they see the people they elect just kind of go along with stuff and then get rolled. Happening. And I think McConnell realized and they pushed back and then Biden realized he'd kind of goofed up on that. That's an issue. And that's why bipartisanship is tough.
Yeah, I agree that Biden messed up on that particular thing. But this idea that I know you fervently believe it, that Republicans are regularly outfoxed by these crafty Democrats, I just totally don't see that happening at all. McConnell certainly is not somebody who gets ruled. And so I never really bought that idea. But I know that you take it almost as an article of faith. But one thing
McConnell less so. McConnell is probably the best at not getting rolled. I would say that. But nevertheless, I'm just saying this is a wide perception in the Republican electorate.
Yeah. I would say that Trump certainly, under President Trump, the White House clearly didn't know how to play the game. But because, it seems like every time he turned around, yeah, they were running afoul of the Administrative Procedures Act or something. But I think generally speaking, they play the game just as well as Democrats do. But, one thing, though, that I did want to mention as well is that it seems to me that what President Biden and Democrats are thinking is that if they get this passed, and they will in some form, is that voters will reward them for making their lives better. I think that's sort of the political calculation. And while I do think that a lot of this stuff is going to make the lives of many voters better, I don't necessarily think that they're going to be rewarded for that. I think polarization is so great that if you're a Trump voter or you're a pretty solid Republican, just because Joe Biden and Democrats in Congress pass something on a party line vote that helps you out, I'm pretty sure you're not going to see that or not going to connect those dots. And there's going to be a strong right-wing media presence going to make sure that you don't connect those dots. And so I don't really see the political gains being nearly as big as a lot of folks on the left think they will be. And I wanted to get your take on that.
So, I'm thinking the past 8-10 years, the Democratic mantra and this talking point that has worked best for them has been, if you elect Republicans, they're going to get rid of your health care. They will actually prohibit you from seeing a doctor. If Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, you will lose your health care. If Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, you will lose your health care. That's sort of been the talking point. And now that'll be what they run on again, is they'll say, listen, we provided extra vision benefits. If they're up for Republicans, they would require you to be blinded. I think that argument is tougher to make. As the longer this goes on, as the longer that Obamacare has been in effect and not been repealed. And again, the bizarre piece of this that strikes me is Obamacare has been the law since, 2010?
Mm-hmm. And it took a little while. I mean, it took a few years for it to actually be implemented.
Yeah,
but still,
it's
still a while. Yeah.
It's kind of part of the plan. But so it's been effective since 2010. And since 2010, Democrats have consistently bemoaned the state of American healthcare and said, this is terrible. This is, I guess that's sort of at some point Republican voters caught onto it for a while. But I'm not sure that all Democratic voters are going to say, listen, you know, we keep being promised that the, you know, the big healthcare promised land is just around the corner, and well, here we had what we, you know, what we wanted, and we're still complaining. I think that's, I don't know. I think there's sort of a Republican talking point in there somewhere of, look, the government can't fix this problem. So,
okay. Oh, no, whole other issue. I completely disagree with the government not being able to fix that particular problem, but that could be a whole other episode. Anyway, I'm sure, again, we will come back to this definitely many times before the budget is actually approved and the infrastructure plan, but it's time to move on to our next story. But before we do that, we will take a quick break. All right, Jay. So, you know, one major concern that many conservatives, well, maybe fewer and fewer conservatives these days, but still I would say some have about all of this federal spending we've been spending the last few minutes talking about, is that it is the threat of runaway inflation. And this week, testifying before the House Financial Services Committee, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that inflation has increased notably and that the Fed expected it to remain high in coming months. And that jump in the consumer price index from this time last year, 5.4%, that's well above that sort of 2% level that the Fed typically targets. And it's actually a higher inflation rate than many economists had expected. Now, Powell said that he believed things would begin calming in around 6 months or so, and that most of the increased inflation is coming in a small number of areas that are tied to the reopening of the economy. So, Jay, I was wondering what you thought. I mean, is the Fed being too cavalier about the threat of inflation? Is it time for them to maybe consider cutting back, for instance, on that $120 billion every month that they're spending in bond purchases, or even maybe even reconsidering not raising interest rates until 2023, as they previously announced?
Yeah, I think it's past time. You know, there's this odd sort of we're talking about, wow, Jerome Powell testified before the House Financial Services Committee. You don't need a weatherman to tell which way the wind blows, right? I mean, people are seeing these prices increase at the grocery store, at the gas pump, all over the place. And if you say, well, look, it's only in this sector or that sector, well, all right, fair enough, but you still got to pay it, right? And so much of the way our CPI was derived is really a little bit based on these sort of funny things where we factor out energy and food, which are two of the biggest things we have to pay for, out of it, on the basis of, well, these things can fluctuate and there's trouble in the Middle East, so that bumps up energy prices, and well, food prices can fluctuate because, well, we had a, you know, whatever bad weather year for you know, the Midwest or something. I think it's past time that the Fed should do something. And the way, you know, inflation works, it's not a it's not like a dial. You just turn it up and turn it down. You know, for example, back in the late 70s, early 80s, it took years to wring the inflation out of the system with high interest rates that also, you know, really hamstring the economy. So that's my concern, is that we're already a little bit too late, and well, they'll raise interest rates, and eventually, you know, the inflation will get wrung out of the economy, but it's you know, may take a tough couple years. So
you know, it seems to me that would be a reasonable analysis if you assume that that Jerome Powell is wrong about this just being a temporary blip due to reopening. And so I would guess from what you're saying that you disagree that this is just sort of a temporary blip that in 6 months is going to kind of reset. But so let me turn this around then. So if Powell is right about this, then would you agree that it makes sense to not make any big changes if this is just a blip?
Yeah, I look, in terms of the Fed, and I'm not a professional economist, and I can say certainly Jerome Powell knows more about economics than I've ever I could ever learn or you know, in a lifetime. That said, he's also a policy guy, and I think sometimes no matter how much smarts you have in a particular field, you're still driven by your ideology and your policy interest. And so I look, in terms of the Fed, generally, you know, no, any sudden move is a bad move, right? I mean, that's not what you want to do. If you want to say, hey, well, we'll just make interest rates 5%. Well, that would fix the inflation problem. It would also, you know, turn us into a pretty sharp recession. So the key is always doing stuff gradually and even and anticipatorily, right? You'd make a little adjustment now because you think inflation might be rising 6 months from now to try to head it off or meet it. Because like I said, there's that lag. So
yeah, but,
I don't want to, you know, this thing of, you know, well, hey, Jerome Powell's chair of the Fred and Jay's this guy on a Saturday morning podcast. But I just think he's wrong as a matter of policy. And there are people who are willing to accept the greater risk of inflation. And conservatives are, for a lot of reasons, much more tend to be inflation hawks than the Democrats do.
But, you know, I think it's important, Jay, to point out that it's not like the Fed is some wild, radical left wing group. Jay Powell was appointed by Donald Trump. And in fact, of the current, I believe there are 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm counting right now, 6 current members on the Board of Governors, and 5 of them were appointed by Republicans. So it's not like this is, you know, some wild liberal scheme or anything like that. I think it's important to, you know, keep that in mind.
But I think there's more, and maybe more what I was getting at was, I'm trying to think of, you know, it's sort of when a hammer is the only tool you have, you know, every problem's a nail,
sure,
kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think, look, there are the Fed by its nature believes in, hey, we can fix everything with monetary policy.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
Or that is the most important tool in the toolbox.
I don't agree with that. I think that maybe more left-leaning members in the past on the Fed might have felt that. But I think if you ask anyone on the Board of Governors, they would say that actually fiscal policy is really a much bigger driver and a much, much better tool, and that monetary policy is a very blunt instrument. So I would disagree with that. I would also say that it seems to me one element of this that Powell mentioned that I think is important to consider is, you know, on the one hand, the Fed has to consider inflation concerns, which may be transient, as Powell seems to think, with concerns about the state of unemployment and the job market, which is doing better. But there are still around like 6.8 million fewer jobs than in February 2020 when those pandemic layoffs began. And there's the concern, we'll talk about this maybe not on this show, but on the midweek show, with the rise of the Delta variant and big pockets of unvaccinated people and so forth. So, I mean, it seems to me that the conservative thing, actually the truly conservative thing to do right now, is to not make any change, to kind of hold the course steady, especially given that, you know, the Fed doesn't know what's going to happen with fiscal policy, given what's going on in Congress. And so not to change another variable in the mix.
We just said, look, we know what's going to happen with fiscal policy. We may not know the exact number.
Right.
But we know it's going to be certainly north of $2.5 trillion, probably close to $3 trillion. And we know what fiscal policy has been over the past year. Again, don't need a weatherman to tell which way the wind blows.
Well, I guess so. At what point would you say that one of us would have to, well, should be able to come back and say, I told you so, or I was wrong? How long, if in 6 months inflation is back down to around 2% or so, then is it okay if I remind you of this?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. And it won't be.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm willing to take that bet. Yeah.
I'm willing to bet on the side of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, but we're
doing sort of an over under,
yes,
on inflation.
I think so.
Okay, so annually adjusted, 6 months from now, where we are. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good. We will revisit that. But in the meantime, why don't we move on to our next story? This week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer introduced the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act. And the bill would decriminalize marijuana at the federal level. remove it from the Controlled Substances Act and begin regulating and taxing it, would also expunge nonviolent marijuana-related arrests and convictions at the federal level, entitled those who are currently in prison on federal nonviolent marijuana-related charges for a hearing to reconsider their sentences, allow marijuana businesses in states where they're legal access to the banking system, as well as the ability to write off business-related expenses on their federal taxes, and as well as earmarking marijuana tax revenue for restorative justice programs in communities that are most affected by what the bill calls the failed federal prohibition of cannabis. So, Jay, what do you think? Is it about time for something like this, or do you see it as kind of too much too soon?
I think it's too much too soon. Maybe just too much, right? In terms of things like the allowing for banks and so forth to deal with this, I think that makes sense based on where state laws are, based on legalization and of other CBD and marijuana light, you know, substances. I don't have a big issue with that. The review of all the new hearings for everyone in federal prison, I think that's a little
that's the extreme. Overkill. You think? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, and because here's the thing. I mean, if you're in, you don't go to federal prison for smoking a joint.
Right.
All right. You go to federal prison for, and I'm reading the statutes, trafficking in 100 to 99 kilograms of marijuana or 100 to 999 marijuana plants.
Sounds like a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so it's not the, hey, a couple college kids got busted at a pot party. The federal laws are necessarily geared towards big interstate
right.
transporters.
I think it's a great point, right?
I have an issue with that, right? Of saying, look, we're going to decrease sentences or have new hearings on those cases. I think that's a problem.
Yeah. And now that's not a lot of people. Right? I mean, I think most of the marijuana related crimes, or most of the people in prison for marijuana related crimes, this is at the state level, and this wouldn't affect
exactly,
that
yeah.
at all. Yeah. Yeah.
Which that's kind of my point, right?
Yeah.
The only people at the federal level are kind of the,
gotcha.
your bigger fish.
Right.
If states wanted to say, listen, we should, you know, look at expunging convictions. I'm actually a big fan of expunging convictions for nonviolent offenses. But again, when you're talking about drug trafficking and you're talking in the hundreds of kilograms, well, that's
yeah.
something a little different than the, you know, possession of I had a dime bag or something on me. I don't know if that's the lingo.
Yeah, yeah.
These days,
can't help you with that. No, yeah. But so yeah, I think that's a reasonable point. But it seems to me there are some things here that should be somewhat uncontroversial. Like, for instance, the idea that marijuana is still federally classified as a Schedule I drug, which is reserved for drugs with no currently accepted medical value. That just seems to me simply untrue, and the idea that hasn't changed is just seems kind of bizarre and wrongheaded to me.
Yeah, to me it looks so. There's two pieces of this, right? There's the economic piece and there's the criminal piece.
Yeah,
the economic piece, I'd say, I'm more or less on board with. And I would put that categorization into the economic piece because, as you say, it has to do with things like you know, what you can do research on and so forth. It's less about, you know, actually getting the drug on the street. So, to me, I sort of roll my eyes a little bit about this, just because the left has its sort of marijuana fetish. I'm willing, my yeah. libertarian soul is also sort of like, yeah, whatever.
Well, you know, and it's not just a left thing, but only around 8% of Americans now think that marijuana should be illegal in all circumstances. At least this is according to a 2019 poll from Pew Research.
Yeah, but most people wouldn't say, if you asked them about should this be illegal in all circumstances, most people are going to answer no.
That's true. But I mean, still polling regularly fine. Well, you don't have to look at polling. We just have to look at public policy, right? 37 states in D.C. have legalized it for at least medical use. 18 states in D.C. have legalized it for recreational use. I mean, it seems to me that and you're kind of saying this, I think, in a way that if you're actually pro-federalism, you want to remove some of these sort of federal fetters that are holding back a lot of state-level innovation in what's still a small industry. It's something like around, I think, legal pot sales in 2020, last I looked, were like under $18 billion. But, you know, compare that to, say, the alcoholic beverage industry, which is like around $250 billion. That's still a small industry, but one that, you know, with certainly has a lot of room for growth, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think so. And, you know, again, I'm a little bit torn on this, in that I'm looking at this from one on the libertarian federalism type piece of it, is I'm generally not in favor of criminalizing a whole lot of stuff, even if I think it's really dumb.
Yeah.
Right. Even if criminalizing behavior, even if I think it's stupid and counterproductive behavior. Likewise, I'm willing to let states do their own thing and experiment. And also, you know, as part of that would be suffer the consequences of those experiments. So, you know, my general position is I don't have a big. Of all the stuff that Chuck Schumer regularly does, this ranks fairly, fairly medium to low on the outrage index for me. So.
And, you know, it seems to me this is an issue that, but I think you're right. This is an issue that for some people is a huge deal. But my sense of
it's like abortion for some.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, because President Biden hasn't actually endorsed this, and honestly, right now, even Schumer knows this probably couldn't get 50 Democratic votes in the Senate right now. And really, while there's a small group of people that's passionately concerned about this issue, I just don't think it's a particularly high priority item for President Biden or for a lot of Senate Democrats, which is why I don't really see. While I think it's something to say, my God, we're at a point where the Senate Majority Leader is introducing a decriminalization. That's something that 10 years ago we probably never would have dreamed of happening, but it's just not a big enough issue to enough people to kind of boost this up the kind of priority chain, I think.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee, as the old song goes. I think, you know, for your Joe Manchin's, Kristen Sinema's, this is a tough look. Why? I'm sticking my neck out and all this other stuff. You know, why do you want me to do this for what is really pretty, pretty minimal gain?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. I mean, it's a niche art audience.
Yeah.
And the way this, you know, politics works is sometimes niche audiences, it works great because you've got a small group of people who can be highly motivated for one issue, and that something a lot of other people don't really care about, so they can get it done. The downside and the flip side of that is, if you're a politician and you go out of your way to do appease some niche audience, even if what you're doing isn't super controversial, and this is kind of where I'd put that, right? Nobody is going to say, my God, I'm voting against Joe Manchin for sure because he voted to legalize pot.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that, if there's a whole bunch of other things stacked against Joe Manchin, and you add on the, oh yeah, he also voted to legalize pot, that makes a difference, right? And are politicians like that willing to stick their neck out to get the pot smoking vote?
Yeah.
Who, let's be honest, Mike, may or may not show up.
Yeah, you know, and also I think it's important to keep in mind that this doesn't necessarily immediately sort of change the lives of people who smoke pot or want to smoke pot, because the state would still, under this law, the state would still have the ability to legalize or not. And if it's illegal in the state, then that kind of game over for that. I mean, for people in that state. But if it's already legal, like in the many states it is, well, you can already get marijuana if you want to. In some states, it's a little more of a, you know, kind of jump through more hoops, like in Ohio, where you have to have a wink, wink, you know, medical condition sort of thing. But it's, yeah. So I didn't really see the benefits outweighing the cost politically for folks, which is why I just don't think we're going to see any sort of action. Though I do kind of hope that at some point the DEA will consider removing this from Schedule One. I know there's actually a lawsuit. Some folks sued them about that. They denied rescheduling it. But I think that at least is the sort of administrative kind of starting point that we might see in the next few years.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I think so. And you're going to see more states with some sort of legalization type thing going on. As more money flows into it. And look, I have a lot of things I could say about that, but
right.
I think it's just a fact. So,
yeah. All right. Well, we're going to do one more story, but before we do that, we will take our final quick break. All right. So, you know, after many years now of resistance from the Pentagon, this could be the moment when we see significant reform in how major crimes in the military are prosecuted. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has, for a while now, been pushing for an end to what's called commander discretion in prosecuting sexual assault cases in the military. And under the current system, senior commanders decide which cases are referred for prosecution, which raises potential conflict of interest concerns. And Gillibrand, proposed legislation would remove this sort of prosecute or not decision from senior commanders and give it to independent military prosecutors, and not just for sexual assault cases. And there's kind of broad agreement that that should be done in those cases, but also for all serious crimes. And she actually has some unusual Senate allies on this, including Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. And Hawley, who I don't typically quote, made what I thought was an excellent point. He said, as a lawyer and former prosecutor, I think there is some value in having continuity, saying any felony crime is going to be handled the same way, no matter what it is. And I guess I also probably should point out that concerns about military commanders making prosecutorial decisions and there being issues with that, that's not just a theoretical concern. There was a Pentagon panel that reviewed the evidence on prosecutions and actually recommended removal of commander discretion for sexual assault cases based on that evidence. And a recent report by the GAO found that Black and Hispanic service members were more likely than whites to be referred over by commanders for court-martial proceedings. So, what do you think, Jay? Does this seem like a good idea?
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
Okay. Because it strikes me as odd.
No, I mean, you're expecting more controversy.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
No, sure. Look, I think that makes sense. I get there's also an argument always when you're dealing with the military that there are other factors that play into these decisions, right? And it's, you know, morale, team morale, and what we're really asking these people to do, and you can't handle the truth, and that kind of thing, right? But no, I think that the general principle that these things ought to be reviewed by someone who is a neutral third party, and that there's some measure of well, as you said, continuity. I'm trying to get the word looking for here, but. Regularity, right? In these proceedings,
sure.
I think that's important. That's a big part of due process, and due process applies to people in the military, perhaps to a lesser extent, but it still does. So, I mean, I'm interested in your perspective as a service member on this.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the fundamental idea is certainly, as you've sort of articulated, is that in a lot of ways, the military is not like the civilian world, and you still have rights, but the different sort of rights. And also, there are certain things, like in the military context, that are crimes that just don't exist in non-military life, like dereliction of duty, malingering, conduct, becoming an officer, those sort of things, you know, I think the idea is that
you get all kinds of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, but the idea is right that military commanders are in, so the argument goes, in a better position to make these sort of judgments that balance the mission of the military and the good of the service against the sort of individual, these individual rights. And so that's why they've been put in this position where they get to make these prosecute or non-prosecute decisions. And, you know, as someone who's been in the military, I appreciate that. I even agree with it. But I don't think there's any reason why that these determinations can't be made by, you know, military prosecutors. It's not like these are people who don't have any knowledge or understanding of the military, as long as there's input from senior commanders, as opposed to, you know, just letting commanders make the call on this themselves. And again, we're only talking about serious crimes here. And and when we talk about senior commanders, these are, you know, these are like generals, and well, these are generals, basically people at that top level. And so, you know, I don't see that there's really a problem with this. And I find it odd that a lot of folks are actually, in the Senate at least, they're okay with doing this for sexual assault, but they're not okay with just making it for all serious crimes, which I don't get the logic of that. I'm with you, and I'm going to gulp here, and Josh Hawley on that one. So
I guess the idea with the sexual assault would be that in so many instances, the commanding officer is male, right? That if you're just looking at the numbers there, and the argument I think would be, well, that's where it's needed more, because you have this kind of all male perspective, patriarchal sort of view, and whether that's accurate or not, but I think that's maybe the genesis of this thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's how it got started, was some high profile, sexual assault cases. So.
All right. Well, I think that actually brings us to our recommendations for this week before we close. Jay, do you have anything for us?
Oh, man. Can I re-recommend something?
You sure can.
So, you know, a book I started reading a couple weeks ago, and I was able just to finish it on vacation last week. The Pioneers by David McCullough. And it is particularly interesting to me because it's about, and it should be to you too, Mike, it's basically about the founding of Ohio.
Okay.
Most specifically the city of Marietta. And it's absolutely fascinating. The people who risked their lives when Ohio was the backcountry. And this is really the first, state that was settled in the Northwest Territory. There are big, you know, heroes you've never heard of, but should know about, Manasseh Cutler, who was a minister. He was a member of Congress, and he was, the person who pushed for the prohibition on slavery, in the Northwest Territory, in what became the Northwest Ordinance. And that the Northwest Ordinance, I think, should get so much more attention than it does. And McCullough gives it a lot of attention. But anyway, then Cutler's son becomes one of these people who immigrates to the Ohio country in Marietta, and they start a settlement there, along with General Rufus Putnam, a Revolutionary War veteran. And it's absolutely fascinating. And you put your problems into perspective. You know, there are all these stories of, you know, people traveling from Pittsburgh to Marietta, and, you know, how many of their children die, you know, during these wow. sorts of things. And again, just coming out of a pandemic, they talk about, you know, well, we had a bad year for the fevers, you know, knocked out a third of our population. The fear of Indian attacks. It's a lot about what sort of, you know, American spirit is all about. So I highly recommend it.
Okay. My recommendation, I think, this week will be a book called Cancer Ward. Not exactly a happy read by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I admire Solzhenitsyn's work just generally, and I picked this up, just happened to find it at a used bookstore. It's a story about a number of folks in, well, a Soviet-era cancer ward in the 1950s, actually. And as you can imagine, it is not a light comedic sort of thing, but it is touching and beautiful and tragic in a lot of ways. But definitely, if you're up for that, if you can kind of handle it, I think just generally you can pick up pretty much almost anything randomly from Solzhenitsyn, and it is worth your time and effort. And I read this a while back, and I was just really taken with it, and really highly recommend it.
Good. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Solzhenitsyn is not always a favorite on the left.
Well, I'm a big fan. That's all I can say. But
well, I'm glad to hear it.
Anyway, well, that is it for this episode. But as soon as we're done, Jay and I will be recording our full-length midweek bonus episode for our Patreon supporters. We'll be talking about vaccine hostility, Breyer's not quite yet Supreme Court retirement, taking some listener questions as well. If you're a Patreon supporter, you will get that in your podcast feed Wednesday morning. And if you're not, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you would like to get that midweek show, but you can't afford to support the show right now, not a problem. Send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make that happen for you. If you're not already subscribing to the show, please do. And also leave ratings and reviews. And especially if you could share episodes on social media, that is really great. And if you want to get in touch with us for any reason, we're at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. You will find links in our show notes. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.